This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A divided U.S. Supreme Court has denied Governor Pat McCrory's request to reinstate North Carolina's voter ID law. The decision means a lower court ruling will stand. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said the law shows willful intent to discriminate against African Americans. It said the legislature targeted the black population with surgical precision to make it more difficult for African Americans to vote. That means voters will not have to show photo ID at the polls in November, and local elections boards have to finalize plans for the original 17 days of early voting rather than the 10 days required under the voter ID law. WUNC Capital Bureau Chief Jeff DeBeery has been following the case and joins us now. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Frank.
Remind us again what the lower court said about North Carolina's voter ID law.
As you just mentioned, that there is discriminatory intent within that law passed by Republicans at the General Assembly in Raleigh 3 years ago. The three-judge panel at the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond ruled that those voting law changes, state voting law changes, disproportionately burdened African Americans and Latinos and were simply unconstitutional. And they undid the law at the end of July.
Not just disproportionately burdened them, but talked about a smoking gun.
Correct.
And willful and surgical precision.
Right.
Targeting.
Right.
Those populations. So how does Governor McCrory respond?
He has referred to Fourth Circuit judges previously and presumably will again, and maybe not in the coming months. He called the Fourth Circuit judges radical and activists. He has maintained throughout that this, and other architects of the law, they've maintained that this is a common sense measure, that, you know, you have to show an ID to get on a plane, you have to show an ID to have a drink, and you should have to show an ID in order to vote, which, you know, that may very well be a common sense argument. I think one of the areas where they have run into trouble is they talk about, you know, this is to prevent fraud. And, you know, by and large, there is no evidence that there has been widespread voter fraud here or really in any other parts of the country. So the governor, shortly after that ruling came out of Richmond back in July, as well as Speaker Pro Tem Phil Berger and Speaker of the House Tim Moore, said that they would be appealing to the Supreme Court, which they did, and that didn't end well. Now, Lee, we should note, legal experts said back then that it was a long shot. It was a Hail Mary.
Right.
To go to the Supreme Court because there are only eight justices. Right. And based on precedent and, you know, the leanings of all these eight Supreme Court justices, it was going to be a 4-4 split and it would kick back to the appellate court, which is what happened.
Didn't have to be a 4-4 split because originally the governor asked Chief Justice Roberts for a decision. In other words, all he wanted was temporary relief.
Right.
Look, we've got this judgment against our law, but we've got an election coming up in 2 months. Why don't we put off that decision until right. after the election? Justice Roberts, will you decide and
right.
tell us how that went?
And he did not do that. Chief U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Roberts is also, if I'm explaining this correctly, he oversees the Fourth Circuit. So he can step in. He could have granted a stay on his own accord had he chosen to. He did not. And as you said, I think part of the reason is because the Fourth Circuit issued such a scathing ruling about what this state law was rooted in, was, you know, just the motivations and the implementation of it.
All the evidence. So
right,
he refers
right.
it to the entire court. Of course, we know about this famous 4-4 split because the Republicans have refused to allow a centrist nominee to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got this 4-4 split. And sure enough, that's what happens, meaning
right.
it goes back to the Fourth Circuit,
correct.
Meaning voter ID, that law will not be in effect in the 2016 elections.
Correct. And it's not just voter ID. So you and I and everybody who's listening who goes to vote, whether it's early or on election day in November, will not have to show any kind of identification. There will also be a 17-day early voting period. There will also be out-of-precinct balloting, meaning if you move or if there's a change in your life, that you can vote elsewhere than where you have lived. There's also same-day registration. There's also pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. So we in the media have maybe not always done the best job of calling this really an omnibus voting law measure. It's that's what it is. It's not just voter ID. There's more to it than that. The early voting will be 17 days, and counties at this point are deciding how many sites are going to be open for 17 days and kind of working on the details of that piece of it. Early voting is the biggest of the out-of-precinct balloting, same-day registration, pre-registration for teens, that kind of thing.
Right. And that got lost in the debate as well because of the debate over, making sure that we have free and fair elections and no fraud. Of course, only 31 cases of voter impersonation in 10 years. So it's hard to see where the evidence was. But then well, then why restrict the number of days for early voting down to 10? Why restrict Sunday voting, which had always been very popular in African-American communities? All of these other questions, early voting restrictions, Sunday voting, and same-day registration, as well as pre-registration of teens. So all of this now back in effect. So what do we think now? This should mean, could it mean, a change in voter turnout? And does anybody try to predict the impact on this upcoming election?
I think people are trying to what extent this ruling affects voter turnout. It is a wait and see approach to some extent. We should note that in 2008, Barack Obama beat John McCain in North Carolina by 14,000 votes. That was his most narrow victory. 4 years later, the president, lost to Mitt Romney by about 92,000 votes, which is a much bigger number. Yet at the same time, it was still the second closest state of any presidential state across the country. So as this state gets bigger, I mean, 92,000 people is less than 1% of the overall population of the state. We have 10 million in North Carolina. So common sense here is that this is going to have an effect on how many people are able and willing to vote. I mean, some of that pertains to the ID, some of that pertains to early voting and providing people with more opportunities. And, you think the logistics of getting to a polling location, 17 days is going to make it easier for some people to vote. Now, will they vote and how much easier? That remains to be seen. But this, I mean, legal experts or in voting law experts say that this ruling does benefit Democrats.
And we should point out it's up to elections boards to figure out how that's done. And, of course, we've seen the chair of the GOP party using very partisan language in directing those elections boards to follow the party line when it comes to making sure that somewhere or another restrictions are still in place.
Right. And Board of Elections, both at the state and at the local level, this is a partisan practice. So there are 100 counties in the state. 66 of these counties have already approved early voting plans. The other 34, they were split. And that's going to go to the State Board of Elections next Thursday. I spoke with somebody from the Board of Elections today, the State Board, who says that he thinks they will be able to get through all of those remaining 34, so about a third of all the counties in the state, those plans next Thursday. And these aren't major discrepancies, but you mentioned Sunday early voting before. That's one piece of the early voting that, the local boards have been split on, whether or not to have early Sunday voting and how many locations to have open for the 17 day early voting period. They only have to, the Fourth Circuit Court did not say, oh, you have to have the same number of early voting polling sites that you had 4 years ago. They just said you have to reinstate the 17 days. So some counties we're going to see only one location for that early voting period. Others, Guilford, for example, has 25 early voting polling locations. So,
all right. Well, how much of an impact do you think this has? And again, given the very direct and explicit language, the condemnatory language that the three judges used to point to the racist or racial discrimination intent, is that a part of this race? And what effect will it have on the governor's race?
It will have an effect. How much? I don't know at this point. We don't know. But this is a state that is growing in diversity. This is a state that is growing in popularity. And it is going to be a benefit to Democratic candidates. How much is the question we'll probably have a better sense of November 9th and on into the late fall.
Well, speaking of the governor's race, this one's becoming quite expensive.
Yes, it is. There was a report out of Wesleyan University last month now, but just last week, about the amount of dollars that have been spent on television advertising. And one, I thought, kind of interesting way to look at it was the amount of money that's been spent on gubernatorial ads, mind you, only through mid-August in North Carolina, is more than that of Montana, Mississippi, Missouri, Utah, Vermont, and West Virginia combined. So there are 12 gubernatorial races in the country this year. This is the one that's going to see the most spending, both fundraising from within the state and the outside money, which has already started to come in. Voters have been treated to, I think it was like 15,500 TV spots.
And more to come.
Yeah.
You've also been keeping an eye on this Senate race between Republican incumbent Richard Burr and Democratic challenger Deborah Ross. What's going on there?
Statistically, at this point, it's a toss-up. It is within the margin of error. That is really a surprise because Deborah Ross was not seen as a particularly strong challenger to Richard Burr. And for me, I think that this race is a pretty good I guess, finger on the pulse of this year of the outsider. How much of a year of the outsider are we really having? Because Democrats are challenging first-term incumbents in the U.S. Senate like Rob Portman and Ron Johnson and Kelly Ayotte. Richard Burr is a two-term incumbent. He spent another decade in the House before that. He is a more prominent member of the U.S. Senate, and he's being challenged by somebody who is a former state legislator and raised a lot of money. But this is really a surprise to political insiders. So we will see if he really is that vulnerable and if he gets ousted. He has made a big TV buy, and I think folks will see and hear a lot of advertisements supporting Richard Burr in the next couple of months.
Stay tuned. Jeff, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeff DeBerry, WNC Capitol Bureau Chief. Just ahead, what kind of influence does the United States have on LGBT rights in other countries? We'll take a look as part of NPR's Nation Engaged project. Stay with us on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.